This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
Fourteen-year-old Jeremy Bright disappeared at a county fair in Oregon. Some believe he was shot by local teenagers. Last November, a Virginia sheriff was brutally shot while on patrol. Before he died, he described his attacker's car. In 1936, a Canadian gold prospector vanished, leaving an unclaimed fortune that may be worth $3 million. Racketeer Leo Cooley has been charged with extortion, robbery, and murder. He has eluded the FBI for 10 years. In November, Michaela Garrett was abducted outside a local store. Her friend gave police an eyewitness description of the kidnapper. In Atlanta, Georgia, the peaceful retirement of an elderly couple has been shattered by unexplained noises and apparitions. Six cases on unsolved mysteries, each needing that one vital clue to close the file forever. Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery. No pain can match the suffering of a parent who's lost a child. No frustration is greater than that of parents whose child is missing, their fate unknown. Our next story concerns a 14-year-old boy named Jeremy Bright, who went to a county fair in Myrtle Point, Oregon in mid-August 1986. Jeremy was never seen again. Since that weekend, a number of clues and rumors have surfaced. Jeremy's parents and the police have come to one inescapable conclusion. Someone living in Myrtle Point, Oregon, knows exactly what happened to Jeremy. They're not talking, but they know. To those who knew him, Jeremy was a popular sports-loving boy. He looked forward to beginning high school in the fall.
He always had lots to do and places to go. He played basketball and baseball and football, and he knew everybody, and everybody knew him. He was always a real outgoing kid.
Every August, the Coos County Fair rolls into Myrtle Point. This is the occasion of a week-long celebration. And to Jeremy Bright and his close friend Johnny, it was one of the high points of the year. Normally, Jeremy lived 100 miles away in Grants Pass, where his mother worked. But during the week of the fair, he and his younger sister were staying with their stepfather, Ole, in Myrtle Point. On Friday, August 15th, Ole went to work before dawn and didn't see Jeremy leave for the fair. But that day, a handful of people saw Jeremy and Johnny enjoying the festivities. Around 4:45 that same Thursday, Jeremy placed a long-distance call to his mother, Diane. He told her he was having a terrific time at the fair. She told Jeremy she'd be back in Myrtle Point in 2 days to pick him up.
I love you, Mom. Bye.
5 hours later, at 9:40 p.m., Jeremy went to a local tavern owned by his grandmother to meet his stepfather, now home from work. He asked to borrow some money from him.
Here, take some of this.
Thanks.
This was the last time Jeremy was ever seen by his family.
Yeah. Bye. You behave yourself. Uh-huh.
2 days later, on Saturday, Diane arrived in Myrtle Point to meet Jeremy. He never showed up.
I went and got my car, and I went to Ole's house, the kids' stepdad's house. And I went in, and on the TV set was his house keys from our Grants Pass apartment, and his wallet, and his new watch that he had told me he'd But I knew when I found those things that he was around somewhere, because he wouldn't leave without them.
As the carnival played on, Diane's fears began to escalate. On Saturday night, she contacted the police. At first, they believed her son had succumbed to the romantic lure of the carnival and had run away.
He did like the fair. There was the thought that perhaps he was hiding out, intending to leave with the fair people, and I've explored that possibility in every way that I can think of. I can't lose sight of the fact that it is possible that he left with members of that fair troop. However, in this particular case, I've talked to family members and friends of his that knew him well, and he was just not, from what I can learn, the type of a kid who would have struck out on his own.
On Sunday, August 17th, 1986, the fair folded up its tent. Myrtle Point returned to normal. Within days, ominous rumors concerning Jeremy's disappearance began to surface.
Think I can get a beer?
Yeah, go ahead.
In Myrtle Point, the week of the fair was a time for partying. According to one rumor, Jeremy attended one of these parties and was offered a beer laced with a powerful, illegal drug.
Hey, we're looking for a beer?
Yeah.
Hey, don't open another one. There's one already open right here.
You mean I can have this?
Sure. Knock yourself out.
Thanks.
I've identified at least two and perhaps three parties where Jeremy was present that the overdose theory could have occurred at. It was reported that Jeremy had a heart murmur, and therefore a stimulant of some kind might have done some bodily damage to him just by his sheer taking it.
An anonymous source told the police another story. He claimed that three local toughs had shown up and harassed Jeremy and his friends while they played in a swimming hole. Then things went terribly wrong.
Is that a gun?
What, this? It's a toy.
It was at the jail where an inmate related to me the information that he had heard wherein one individual from the Myrtle Point area was target practicing or shooting indiscriminately in the water in the area where Jeremy was swimming.
All right, I'm just going to sight it.
Don't move.
Show me what you're made of now.
Yeah. That's better. Pierce his ear.
Yeah, I bet you can.
You think so?
Yeah, but see if you can do it.
All right, I'm
going to
try this.
You look good in here.
Man. They subsequently took him to a cabin, maybe within 10 miles of the Myrtle Point area, and attempted to nurse him back to health, to no avail, that he died as a result of that injury, either from loss of blood or from infection or what have you. That same source through the jail indicated that his body would be found within 200 feet of this cabin in a shallow grave.
Police searched the area surrounding the cabin and found nothing.
All the rumors were hard to handle. All of them are hard to think about. Every time I'd hear a new one, I'd have nightmares for a week or so. The one that I hope is not what happened is the one where he suffered for 2 weeks before he died and they buried his body. Because the thought of him suffering for 2 weeks just makes me sick.
There were two more strange clues. Jeremy was last seen by his family on Thursday night. The following night, the sister of Jeremy's friend, Johnny, had a disturbing encounter.
It was Friday night of the fair, and it was between midnight and 1 when we were leaving my sister's apartment, and we came down the stairs, and we got to the last stair, and we almost ran into one of the neighborhood guys, and I jumped back because it startled me because he was completely covered in blood, and I mean, it was just all over him, and it kind of scared me.
What happened to you?
Well, this?
He goes, oh, this happened hours ago, and he just laughed, and then he went into one of the apartments.
A half hour after this encounter, Johnny arrived at the same building where another sister lived. According to her, he was overwrought and terrified, but didn't want to explain.
Whether it is just coincidence or whether they're directly related to Jeremy's disappearance is another one of the mysteries that you still have to sort through to try to determine what indeed did happen.
The three or four people whose names keep reappearing in all the rumors and all of the reports, they're not exactly what anybody would call pillars of society. But as long as these men are out on the street, they can hurt somebody else's child the same as they hurt mine. And if nobody comes forward, that's leaving them out there. And if they did to my son what people are saying they did and what they've been heard themselves say that they did, they've got no business on the public streets. And we can't do nothing until we get the whole story and make them pay for what they did to my boy.
I would just encourage anyone, especially those people who I feel have information that would help this investigation greatly, to just simply have the courage to say, yeah, I'm scared to death, but in a case like this, my being scared doesn't warrant this family's pain.
If you've ever been stopped for a traffic ticket, you might have noticed that the officer approached cautiously. Imagine what's going through his mind. You know who he is because of his uniform, but he has no idea who you are. To him, it could be another routine traffic violation. Then again, it could be that one case where the unexpected happens and his life is on the line. Our next story is about just such a case. It happened in a rural county in Virginia where a police officer had not been killed for over 20 years until last November. In the early morning hours of Friday, November the 4th, 1988, Patrolman John Martin, a 17-year veteran of the Lee County, Virginia Sheriff's Department, was making his regular rounds when he noticed something unusual.
...604 to Jonesville.
Go ahead, 604.
I'll be checking a parked vehicle out at the Western Lee County Health Clinic.
10-4, 604.
John Martin reported to our dispatcher in Jonesville at 2:58 a.m. on the morning of November 4 that he was checking a car parked behind the Lee County Health Clinic in Ewing, Virginia.
604 to Jones.
Go ahead.
This vehicle just pulled out on me.
And then he came back and said that the car was moving out on him, and that he was stopping it about halfway down the driveway, and that it was a large, light brown car, possibly a Cadillac, and he couldn't give the license number because it was on the inside of the car in the back window.
That was the last transmission John Martin made to the dispatcher. Authorities believe that Martin left his patrol car and approached the driver to question him.
See your operator's license, please.
He didn't respond to the radio, so we had an officer probably 7 miles away that we sent to check on him.
When I arrived at his location, I found Officer Martin lying in the driveway of the clinic. At the time of arrival, I didn't know what had happened to him. When I got to him, he told me, Doug, I've been shot and I'm hurt bad. I contacted the dispatcher and had a rescue squad dispatched.
Rescue squad's on the way, you're gonna be all right.
You know, I knew he'd been seriously wounded, and of course he was a good friend of mine, as well as a fellow officer. I knew at the point when I found him, he was probably critically injured, and it was very important that I be able to maintain the scene and to be able to get what information I could from him while he was conscious. And that was the most important thing to do at the time, and that's what I attempted to do. Did you see who did it, or did you get a description of the vehicle?
He was in his mid-20s, had a mustache.
I'd ask him about the automobile and about the tag. He advised me the tag was in the rear window, that it was a dealer tag. However, he could not read the registration numbers from the tag, but he was able to give me a rough description of the vehicle as a Buick, light brown or tan, and it was a Buick from the 1970 to 1977, perhaps, one of the large Buicks.
Martin was able to give Officer Parsons one final piece of information about the license plate. It read Land of Lincoln, which is the motto for the state of Illinois.
Did you shoot into the car or shoot anyone?
Yes, I shot at the vehicle.
He had advised me he had emptied his gun into the car. I checked his weapon and it was empty. He had fired all six rounds from his revolver.
Martin was rushed to the nearest hospital, 22 miles away, suffering from three bullet wounds. Doctors removed a .44 caliber bullet from his body, but he lapsed into a coma. 3 days later, John Martin died. On November the 10th, John Martin was laid to rest with full honors. Police officers from seven states and hundreds of area residents came to pay their final respects to the 39-year-old father of four.
I just thought it wouldn't happen to him. And we had talked about it, but it don't feel real, because I just feel like an officer's job is to protect the other people. And that's all he was doing. But we just, out of this, we're hoping that we can possibly catch whoever done it. That's our main priority right now. That's all we want.
2 weeks ago, a man believed to be John Martin's murderer was arrested by sheriff's deputies in Illinois. On November 5th, Effingham, Illinois police impounded a stolen car burnt almost beyond recognition. Inside, they discovered evidence that this was the car that was used in John Martin's killing.
The Lee County Sheriff's Office was immediately contacted, and their first question was, does your burnt car have a bullet hole in the door? And our answer was yes, and at which point they decided to send a team of investigators to Effingham and continue the investigation.
Police believe that the bullet holes were caused by John Martin's gun. During their investigation, authorities uncovered information that linked a 24-year-old man named David Wayne Mills to the car. During a search of the home where Mills was living, investigators found additional evidence connecting him to the murder of John Martin. When Mills arrived home, he was immediately arrested. Mills admitted being present when Officer Martin was killed, but claims that an accomplice fired the gun. This alleged accomplice has been questioned, but no formal charges have been made. On January 5th, Mills was extradited back to Virginia, where he is currently being held without bail. During questioning, he gave authorities information which led them to a .44 caliber pistol. Ballistics tests have confirmed this was the gun that killed John Martin. David Wayne Mills has been charged with first-degree murder. However, the prosecuting attorney may elevate the charge to capital murder, which carries the death penalty. In a moment, the story of a mysterious Canadian prospector who left a fortune that may be worth $3 million. Someone watching tonight may be his heir. Last year on Unsolved Mysteries, we told you about George Marsh and Charlie Shield, who when they died left unclaimed fortunes. Both cases were solved, and legitimate heirs came forward to claim their inheritance. Tonight, we have another missing heir story.
Dan Willens, a mysterious Canadian prospector, spent a lifetime finding gold. According to public records, he left an unclaimed estate of nearly $100,000. But Willens' wealth may be worth much, much more than that. Some say as much as $3 million. And his heirs may well be alive today in the United States. Dan Willens was one of thousands of men who poured into Canada wanting to strike it rich. They came from all walks of life. Between treks in the wilderness, he settled in rough mining towns like Haileybury in Ontario, Canada, where Dan Willens was well known by 1925.
Oh, he's laughing. There we go, aces, twos, nine.
Thrown together by fate and greed, these rough prospectors spent their nights playing poker and their days hoping to find that one strike that would make their fortune.
Gentlemen, the game is yours.
Dan Willens and his closest friends relied on each other to share information on stakes and claims. But even they didn't know who Dan Willens really was.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Okay. He was very private. Now, I don't know if I ever listened to him ever brag about himself. Never. Never. Or comment about his past. Never. Never.
I consider him as a gentleman, always well-dressed, and his walk and his stance, I would take it to be a military man.
Good night. Really good.
Yep. Dan Willens had a partner, Bill Koshner. One night, another miner pulled out a map. He told Dan and Bill that there might be gold in Red Lake, 850 miles to the west.
You've heard of Red Lake?
Heard of it?
I've heard of it, yes.
Well, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right here. I've staked some claims on this point, and I've got some real good showings.
I think we should go there.
I think you're right.
Dan Willens and Bill Koshner journeyed for more than a month through the desolate outback. In the next year, Willens and his partner staked 12 claims around Red Lake. Finally, their hard work turned up tiny glints in the sand that meant gold. From that small beginning, one of Canada's most profitable gold mines sprang to life. And with it, the community of Red Lake. The Koshner-Willens mine drew $45 million worth of gold, worth $1 billion in today's values. Running a lucrative mining company didn't interest Dan. His real love was panning for gold. Dan Willens continued his solitary prospecting. Often he disappeared to the wilderness alone for months at a time, still staking claims and sifting through sand. There was another side to Dan Willens. The rough outdoorsman led a double life as a gentleman of culture and breeding. Every autumn, he'd take over an entire floor of the elegant King Edward Hotel in Toronto, wax his mustache, and entertain his friends with lavish amounts of champagne.
I mean, I did go hunting, but not for large game, just the small things.
He had a social life that very few people knew anything about. He loved life. There's no doubt about it. He loved life. He liked sociability. There was no doubt about this.
From prospector to gentleman and back again, Dan Willens kept up this double life for years. In the autumn of 1936, Dan Willens mysteriously vanished while on one of his prospecting trips. Baffled by his partner's absence, Bill Koshner began to search for Willens.
He said he went to his cabin and found everything accurately in place. He got that eerie feeling that he had just left things in place and was gone and wouldn't be found. When he disappeared, the story was that he'd taken a trip into the bush and he was never heard of again, that he was lost, that he perished. Now, Dan was a good bushman, and he wasn't a weak man. He was a very strong man, and I don't think for 1 minute that he was lost. I think he went back to England and took his social place in life.
I'm in for five.
Five? Is that all?
Some believe that Dan may have been killed after a poker game and his body thrown down an abandoned mine shaft.
I think I'm going to take a chance.
If you got into a poker game, it's just hard to say what might have happened.
Give me the one I want.
Money And losers don't work too well together, especially if they lose their money. Eh?
I'll see you five and I'll raise 20.
He was a good poker player.
The truth of Dan Whelan's disappearance remains as elusive as his past. Only a handful of clues exist. He appeared to be from England. He was skilled as a horseman and at cards. He never married. One prospector believes he may have had a sister in England. His unclaimed estate was valued in 1936 at $71,000. This money, held by the Public Trustee of Ontario, is now worth nearly $100,000. But we know that Whelan's owned half the shares in the Koshner Whelan's mine, and that his partner Bill brought back most of those shares 7 years after Whelan's vanished. Those shares alone would have been worth at least $850,000 in 1943. 45 years later, they could be worth much more. Yet no one can locate the money. Terry Howes, a Toronto-based tracer of missing heirs, has learned that Dan Whelan's may not be his true name.
We have reason to think that his real name was Dalton Thomas Whelan's, and we feel that there are heirs either in Britain or the U.S., somewhere in the world. Today, if an heir turned up, and we have every reason to think that their heirs are going to turn up, the estate could be worth in the vicinity of $3 million, depending upon the interest that's been paid over the years.
Update. Within days of our broadcast, Davy Whelan's, a New York businessman, called our 800 number, claiming he might be one of the heirs to Dan Whelan's fortune.
My grandfather, we have determined, came from the UK to Ontario in 1895. At that time, he was 11 years of age. We believe he traveled with another family member. And we also have been told that there was a cousin someplace up in the outback of Ontario. But there was never any contact with that individual through the years. So when this Unsolved Mysteries program aired and this Dan Whelan's, a bushman from Ontario, was disclosed, it certainly was an exciting possible link for our family tree searching.
Davy Whelan's flew to Toronto to meet Joe Perkins, one of Dan Whelan's last surviving friends. He brought along photographs of his grandfather, Harold Whelan's, and his great-grandfather, John Whelan's, to see if there was a family resemblance.
It was uncanny. I couldn't believe it. The similarity of the face, the nose, spacing of the eyes, forehead. And I think if you took the beard off the old man, they'd look like twins.
Indeed, there does seem to be a strong resemblance. Our great-grandfather John, grandfather Harold, and prospector Dan Whelan's, all blood relatives. Is Davy an heir to Dan Whelan's fortune?
Certainly money is important to everybody. And if the Ontario government is holding considerable assets that could rightfully be claimed by a Whelan's, then I'd like to see that happen. I don't know if it'll be me and my cousins or not, but maybe now we can get some Whelan's to come forward, and maybe we do have a strong case to be made. And certainly we are going to take the next steps to pursue that possibility.
Next, the story of Leo Khoury, a volunteer softball umpire active in his local church, and a suspected murderer and arsonist who has eluded the FBI for 10 years. On March 19, 1975, in Richmond, Virginia, a bodyguard named Chuck Kernighan was murdered and his body placed in a trunk. Police were told that Kernighan's corpse was driven to the Rappahannock River, weighed down with a bumper from a 57 Chevrolet, and thrown overboard. Kernighan's body has never been found. The police believe that local businessman Leo Khoury was responsible for this contract killing. In the mid-70s, the same Leo Khoury was a volunteer softball umpire and active in his local church. Leo was married with four children and a member of the American Legion.
Leo was a nice guy to many people. there are people that are close to him that characterize him as a caring, sensitive individual. However, our investigation turned up another Leo Corey, and that is the leader of a racketeering enterprise who made a living committing crimes.
Then on April 20th, 1979, Leo Corey was placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list as an accused murderer. He has eluded the authorities for 10 years. Corey was a successful restaurant owner who was fiercely competitive. Reportedly, he tried to force his rivals out of business by sending in thugs to terrorize the patrons. On January 15, 1977, Corey's friends brutally attacked innocent customers at the Mailbox restaurant. One person died and several were injured.
It became apparent after a few months of investigation that Leo Corey was the very center of a racketeering enterprise, and that means that he ran an organization that their primary income was through illegal purposes, be it frauds, extortion, murder, whatever, but their income was from crime.
While the FBI suspected Corey was responsible, they could not indict him, because his inner circle was extremely loyal.
I'm gonna give you everything.
They often picked vulnerable groups, like the local gay community, as victims for his scams and extortions.
I want you to kill a man for me.
I'll do it.
In October 1977, Corey asked Eddie Lohr to make a hit on restaurant owner Jim Hillier. A few days later, Corey's scheme backfired when Eddie Lohr was found hiding outside Jim Hillier's home.
Johnson, get him up!
This arrest was the turning point for the FBI and directly led to Corey's indictment.
I've heard enough, okay? You have.
We later learned that he was there, allegedly at Leo Corey's behest, to kill Hillier, to eliminate Hillier as competition in the restaurant business.
What are your options?
Lohr agreed to work with the FBI. He was equipped with a hidden microphone, and the FBI secretly recorded a conversation with Corey for their investigation. This is the actual recording of Leo Corey's voice in the car.
I can't understand you telling something about this guy. Don't say anything on the phone. I don't care if you believe he's not going to happen. Don't say anything.
Based on the surveillance tapes, on October 31st, 1978, Leo Corey was indicted by a federal grand jury. He was charged with murder, attempted murder, extortion, assault, racketeering, fraud, and arson. But the day before the charges came down, Leo Corey disappeared from Richmond, Virginia.
Leo Corey is a very competitive person, and it would not surprise me, and it's been done in the past with top 10 fugitives, where they pick up the phone and call the agent who's looking for them simply to tweak their nose. That would be an interesting call. I'd just like to know he's alive.
Over the last 10 years, the FBI have recorded 165 sightings of Corey, mostly on the East Coast, but also in Brazil and the Middle East. The FBI are offering a $25,000 reward in this case, and have even put up billboards around the country with Leo Corey's face on them. His FBI file is now 38 volumes thick.
What we come up with is the most logical location for Leo Corey and what he's doing is probably Florida, drugs, and we believe he's still closely associated with the gay community.
November 19th, 1988, a 9-year-old girl named Michaela Joy Garrett and her best friend were given $5 by the friend's father to spend at a local market in Hayward, California, a suburb of Oakland. The two girls rode from Michaela's house to the market on their scooters.
Michaela came and asked if she could go. And I said yes, and she jumped up and down and said, oh, goody, goody. They went to the market, and that's the last time we've seen her.
Although Michaela's house was only 4 blocks from the market, her parents insisted she be accompanied by a friend.
She usually made a trip to the store at least once a day or every other day or so. She'd get a friend and go up there on their scooters. We never let her go to the store by herself. She always had to be with somebody.
When they came out of the store, Michaela's scooter was gone.
Over there.
It was over by a car, and when she went over to get the scooter, a man stepped out of the car and grabbed her from behind and threw her into the car.
Michaela!
Michaela's friend went back into the store, advised the clerk in the store that her friend had been kidnapped, and then they called the police. The biggest thing that makes this one a little different than most is that we do have a suspect description, we do have a suspect vehicle description, and we do have a witness that saw this take place.
Look at the pictures and see if there's any...
Michaela's friend was shown mugshots of possible suspects, but was unable to identify any of them. She was, however, able to assist police artists in creating a composite of the suspect. She described a white male, age 18 to early 20s, approximately 6 feet in height, with dirty blonde shoulder-length hair. The man had a slender build and a pockmarked complexion. The car he was driving was a large American model, a few years old, in poor condition. It appeared to be brown or tan in color.
Right now, what we need to know, if anybody was to call, is we need a name, a place where we could find Michaela or the kidnapper. Nobody has to leave a name. All they have to do is just give us that tip that we need to act.
Life just is not the same, and it won't be the same again until Michaela comes home.
Next story, we will meet a retired couple, Jim and Kay Tatum, who are sober, reliable people. Jim was a career Army officer, Kay an accountant. But in their new home, they've experienced unexplained sounds and objects that move for no apparent reason. Experts call this poltergeist activity. Now, some believe that such activity is not caused by ghosts, but rather by psychokinesis, a hidden psychic power in the mind of an individual which unconsciously moves objects through space. Now, could it be that Jim and Kay Tatum caused their own hauntings? This is a quiet suburb near Atlanta, Georgia, where Jim and Kay Tatum build a new home. There they plan to retire, but 5 months after they moved in, the Tatums began to experience unusual events that forced them to put their house up for sale. For this reason, they requested we not show it, but they did allow us to film inside. One night in January of 1986, Kay Tatum woke from a restless sleep. Not wanting to disturb her husband, she left their bedroom. She sensed a strange presence.
Jim, I'm in here. Jim, I'm in here.
Kay had seen a glimpse of a man walking past the open doorway.
Jim!
And at first, I thought it was my husband. And I went into the bedroom, and there my husband was in the bed. So I thought we had a burglar.
No.
Jim searched the house.
It was definitely a man, and he was swinging his arms slightly, and his head was slightly bent, and he walked briskly past me. It was nothing that you could see through.
There's no evidence of any entry. There's no evidence of anyone having been in the house. And I thought perhaps Kay had been using an overactive imagination.
As the night passed into dawn, Kay Tatum lay awake and wondered.
I had fear and I was perplexed about what happened. And while I was tossing and turning, I suddenly remembered that I didn't hear any sound as he passed me. And I still am unable to figure out why it happened.
After Kay's first experience, 2 months passed by without incident. Then one night, Jim was repairing a ladder that led up to their attic. His work was interrupted when Kay called him for dinner.
In a minute.
I specifically unplugged the drill because it's a very old drill. I thought it might be dangerous to leave it plugged.
As the evening wore on, he wanted to watch a movie, and I decided to go upstairs and read.
1 hour later, Kay heard the sound of the drill outside her room. She thought that Jim was teasing her about having seen a ghost, and she tried to ignore the noise. Eventually, she went into the hallway. It was empty, and the drill was unplugged.
I was really frightened, and I reached down and felt out, and it was ice cold. It had not been turned on.
I was very confused. I knew very well that something was happening because Kay is very level-headed, and she was truly frightened.
These incidents continued. One night, Kay heard the sound of coins falling in a bowl, but she was alone in the room. Another time, while cooking, Kay felt 2 sharp tugs on her blouse.
After that incident, I decided we have a problem in this house. There's something going on. It's not something that we can understand or explain, but there's something definitely going on.
This is where most of the things have been happening.
Uh-huh.
These occurrences seem to center around Kay. Parapsychologist William Roll visited the house to try to interpret these events.
You know, the question comes up, why is this family having these experiences? Is there a sort of ghost that has come back to haunt them for some unknown reason or what's taking place? A lot of people have these experiences. It's part of who we are as humans to have so-called psychic experiences.
I see. Uh-huh. But the pop was up here on the wall.
I see. Okay.
Roll believes that memories can actually be transferred to physical objects, and these residual memories may be triggered by ordinary people.
The nature of his presence seems to be a teasing type of thing, as though it's teasing us.
In February, Jim finally had his first experience. It started with this small bell located in the guest room. Jim had a habit of waking hours before his wife. When Kay woke, she would ring the bell if she needed him upstairs.
I'd grown used to climbing the stairs after hearing the bell. And so I did so, and it wasn't Kay. She was asleep. So I went in and looked at the bell, and it was there. And I thought, obviously, I heard something else other than the bell.
After the third time this happened, the couple decided to make up a code in order to outwit the entity.
If it rings 3 times, I'll come on up the stairs.
All right, we'll do that.
So the next time, it rang 3 times. I knew this was Kay because this was our signal. But Kay was sound asleep. And the bell was in the other bedroom where it stays. So I went in and looked at it. I turned around and walked out the door, and the thing rang again. Then I began to see how Kay felt. I mean, I was frightened. The hair stood up on my neck. I told Kay then, I says, no more bell. I'm not going to answer that bell anymore. And that bell has not rung since.
I've never seen him like that before.
There are a number of haunting cases that are not very striking, not very strong, but where the phenomena nevertheless are disturbing to the family. It might be a bell ringing, a fleeting glimpse of an apparition. The events are trivial, but they're deeply upsetting to the family because they don't fit into the picture that most of us have of the world. And that image of the physical world, particularly of our home, is intricately related to who we picture ourselves as being.
The story about the bell gets me emotional because this was a real turning point in my life. I knew then that there are things that are unexplained.
The Tatums feel that their home is no longer their own. They have decided to move, leaving the entity, if that indeed is what it is, to live in the house alone. For every mystery, there is someone, somewhere, who knows the truth. Perhaps that someone is watching. Perhaps it's you.